Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
Thanks to all of you again for spending time. As Jed said, just recently launched my own strategic and creative consulting company. No coincidence that happened during the largest economic crisis in the history of recording economic crises. But as you said, I left Condé Nast, which if you aren't familiar, that's the people that own Vogue and the New Yorker, Wired, things like that, where I was building a global strategic and creative agency for them. So without further ado, I'm gonna jump in and just talk with you guys about what we'll be discussing this evening. And again, as I said, just feel free if you have questions to drop them into the chat. I can't see it right now, but we'll leave some time at the end to jump into it. So I wanted to focus tonight really around how to, especially early stage companies, early mid stage companies, use digital marketing broadly to help you accelerate your growth, which I assume is something that most entrepreneurs are interested in. We talked about me, and that's my email address down there at the bottom, justeschner@hay.com. But feel free to find me there or on LinkedIn if I can follow up on anything here or be of assistance as an advisor or a consultant to you. That ends the pitch. So this is what we're going to talk about this evening, just to give you a sense. I also, we'll talk a little bit about what's changed. We're going to talk a little bit about brand strategy and the channels available to you, especially as an early stage company. And then I really want to focus on content marketing, because I think that's the space where most, you know, earlier stage companies can really get massive bang for their buck. So first, let's talk a little bit about the old world. And here we're sort of going back even to from the mid 20th century up even through, you know, the early 21st century. And I think here, it won't be a surprise to any of us who were alive at that time, big brands could dominate their categories. And they could really do that through brute force spend, because there are only a few media channels. I think probably a lot of us remember actually, you know, flipping dials on a television, channels turned off at night, and then you had maybe your local paper, maybe the Times or the Post. And that was it. That was a lot of what you could do that wasn't direct mail or things like that. And even direct mail was pretty capital intensive. You had to buy a list and send out a lot of things to get even any response. And then the other side too, it was even more disadvantageous to small companies, because buying media in bulk, like most things, is more efficient. So those big companies had tons and tons of advantages. So flash forward a little bit, and let's talk about sort of where we are today. I know shatter zone is kind of a dramatic word, but here's an interesting stat for you. In 2002, Friends season premiere, which was in September 2002, had 34 million viewers in the US alone. And that was, it was a big entertainment event, but it wasn't the Super Bowl. It wasn't a massive premiere. It was their eighth season. Again, it was a big hit, but you reached 34 million viewers in the US. Come forward to 2019. Game of Thrones is premiering its series finale season. Again, one of the biggest media events, and it got 11.7 million viewers. So just think about that, right? And you can correct for things like HBO is subscription and things like that, but that's still a huge difference. You know, a 66% difference in the number of viewers for one of the biggest media events of a season. And that's not because entertainment consumption is off. That's because there are near infinite choices for almost any of us. The other thing, again, today we have near perfect audience targeting. You used to be able to target by geography, and geography was a proxy for household income. But that was about all you really had. Today you can, you know, if I want to specifically target Jed, I can probably find him. Even platforms like Facebook had to introduce a data blur because people were accidentally outing people. And accidentally, there's a pretty famous case of Target accidentally letting a young woman's father know she was pregnant because of her social behavior. She got targeted for pregnancy related items. So now they've introduced a blur so that you can't target exactly one person. The other thing is all of these big platforms, whether it's Google, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, Snap, all of them have self-serve ad platforms. That means anybody here with a credit card can go on and run an ad campaign in a pretty targeted way with very standard creative formats. Also importantly, interesting, go back like 30 years, if you wanted to scan an image, it was a $10,000 two-week process You had to send it away to some place where there was a giant room. Now, right, you can scan almost anything. You can print almost anything. So the proliferation of creative and production tools, even I'm guessing most of you have edited some level of video on your mobile phone. Again, go back even 10 or 15 years, that was hugely expensive and required really specialized skills. So all that to say, basically, we've created this radically level playing field in terms of media, in terms of being able to reach the audience you want to reach and create the assets that you need. And that really means that the only big variable between a small company and a big company is either the quality of your ideas, the coherence of your brand, or your spend. But even too, think about this, for those of you who play mobile games or on Instagram, if you scroll through and you see the same ad from a company 10 or 15 times, you just get irritated. So bigger spend actually isn't necessarily better. You just become a little more irritating and you reach wear out or you feel invasive. So now let's really focus on digital marketing for a second. And this is just to illustrate some of the non-media things that have changed quite a lot. Again, I think we're all probably pretty familiar with the move from desktop to mobile. Interesting there too, you know, the old internet, even the internet in 2005, was kind of a hyperlinked version of the old media world. You know, if you wanted to see NBC, you go to NBC.com. If you wanted, you know, WashingtonPost.com. Now consider how much you digest through Apple News or through like the various feeds that you access. So we actually have an entirely new media landscape. Also again, from geo-targeting to almost, so addressability just means finding your audience. We have near perfect addressability. Again, even back in 2005, you'd run banner campaigns and you'd look to see who clicked and then what did they do once they clicked to your site. Now again, you have, and when I say things like AI, machine learning driven pathing optimization, just Google AdWords does that, right? Like it adjusts the bidding on different words. It'll serve to different people. All these platforms are trying to earn more ad dollars and generate more attention. So they do a lot of the intelligent stuff themselves. I think too, again, think back to banners and email and all that 15 years ago, very low funnel, right? It was trying to get you to apply for a mortgage or go to your car dealership or buy something, you know, buy bleach now. Now you can do full funnel marketing and sales only in digital. I mean, again, this, even think about too, now that we don't get together as humans anymore, we're doing this, like you can do the entire funnel from high level awareness all the way to like last click sales. Also too, I mean, I know in 2005, there was MySpace. It wasn't that significant a platform. Now again, legitimately half of the internet world is on social platforms, and that's not even counting search, where outside of China, Google generally dominates that entire market. The last important thing that will feed into what we're talking about at the end is again, the old model was ad supported content, just like a TV channel, just like a newspaper with subscription costs that only offset a tiny bit of their cost. Everything else was ad supported and those ads were really clear. It was very easy to understand what an ad was and what an article or a TV show or a video was. And now there's a huge amount of blur between what is entertainment, what is information, what is news, and what is marketing. And there are regulations obviously around having to declare when something is an ad or not. But everything, not everything, but lots and lots of things look like content, and invasive interruptive advertising is less and less important. So with all those conditions, those challenges, these opportunities, this broad democratization, how especially does a new brand or a smaller company thrive in this space? Just a few key things I would say, and these are really critical. And I think you probably won't be surprised by understanding your audience and what they need. You probably won't be surprised by wanting to create good content. That first one though, about a clear, coherent, and consistent brand is really important. And I wanna talk next about what I mean by a brand and differentiation. I don't want to offend anybody. If anybody created some of these videos that I've screenshot from today, I'm not coming at you, I promise. But I watched, my friend Josh Beard, who's on here, sent me about 25 videos from an AFWERX, from a specific AFWERX challenge. And one of the deliverables for your pitch was a 100-second long form pitch video. I watched all of them. These are screenshots pulled from just a handful. One thing I learned is there's an entire sector devoted to middle-aged white guys at computers locked in desperate battles with solar flares, and that whenever someone's hacking, they always wear a hoodie. But even this is just the visuals. The music is the same. The fonts are the same. The voiceover, you can tell, was sort of sourced from a stock voiceover source. The fonts were the same. Music was sort of fast-paced, but again, very generic. And the content, importantly, too, was around features, not benefits. So things like unified data library were called out in every single video I watched. And that's not a bad thing, but some people spent 10 or 15 seconds of their 100 seconds on that. What this all means, though, is that especially when in-person presentations and meetings and handshakes are really limited, that being distinct and memorable, having a clear brand, is really important. And if you blur with your competition, like all four of these companies did, you basically wasted your time and money. Now, one of these four, one of these people certainly won this pitch, but I would argue it certainly wasn't on this video. And all these people spent time and money creating them. And I think they did it without a clear sense of who they were and why they were different. Or even if they know that, it didn't come through in their materials. So let's talk about this. Obviously, you need to know what you are marketing before you begin marketing it to people. Beyond that, I think there are some really important things about having a clear brand. One of them, from an internal perspective, it gives you focus. It helps you understand your not just your product or your service, but your beliefs and values. It helps you onboard new clients, new employees. And importantly, it really simplifies your marketing and comms decisions. Any one of you that have an early stage business probably wonder whether you should sponsor an industry event or run a LinkedIn campaign around a white paper or hire a PR firm to get coverage or sponsor a hole in a golf tournament. None of those are bad things. They're probably all good. The question is, which is best? And with a very clear brand, you have a better chance of understanding that. From an external differentiation perspective, it means that people will understand why you and not your competition. And again, especially when you're talking about software services that can be spun up with relatively quickly and can all look similar to folks, that's really critical. It can also, it should increase the likelihood of your word of mouth or even your media leads leading to a conversion. And then last, a clear brand will help you grow. It'll just help you grow faster. Now when we talk about brand, again, I find a lot of people, especially founders, and again, I've worked with very senior people at some of the biggest software companies in the world and some of the biggest entertainment brands in the world. When you're not a marketer, a lot of people think about a brand as your font, your logo, your look. And those are just the visual assets. But what's behind them is actually, I'd argue, considerably more important. The truth is, though, too, brand strategy and creative is some of the most subjective work you can do. I go back all the way, like when Pepsi relaunched their logo, I think in 2008, it was famously something like a $12 million 8-month project. And what they ended up with was with a logo that looked a whole lot like the Obama campaign logo that had just been successful with about 400 pages of PowerPoint behind it. And I'm not being critical of it, but just saying it's really subjective work. And either it tends to be super complex and deeply, deeply researched and wildly expensive and time consuming, or it ends up templated and mediocre and focused on assets and not ideas. So in between those middle grounds of, do you hire a designer you know, or do you go engage one of the biggest branding firms on earth and spend, you know, half your available capital? I think there are some tools and things that you can use to get to a good sweet spot. The first is a positioning framework, which is just medium fancy for, do you understand who you are and why you're different? And then your personality, the output, like your voice, how you look and sound, and then also how you behave in the world. So this is one of the best examples. So this framework is called Make, Sell, Believe, and that goes from top to bottom. And again, this obviously Nike had to spend a lot of time on this, but they also have a gigantic company with huge reach. So if you think about this, like what they make is innovative, sustainable, high-performance athletic gear. But so do a lot of people. There's a lot of really great companies that make that. What do they sell? And what you sell is sort of like why Nike and not Reebok. And sometimes there'll be a quality question there for sure, or just a preference question. But a lot of times you're actually making an intangible choice. And this is sort of the root of brands actually, is how to differentiate effectively generic products. Like there, while there's arguably a taste difference between Coke and Pepsi, there's not a utility difference. It's sugar and caffeine and water and bubbles. Like it doesn't really matter, but those brands make it matter. And so for Nike, this manifests as just do it and all the things that come behind that. I'd say too that they just launched a video either yesterday or today that's called You Can't Stop Us. You should watch it. It's an amazing piece of creative and it's inspiring, but it's also a great way to see how someone's brand informs their actions in a really difficult time. And then this core, the believe, deep, deep down. Now you will never see this language at the bottom in anything Nike from a marketing perspective. But this is the why they exist in the world. If you have a body, you're an athlete, and innovation can help you. And this, I think, helps guide them and helps guide this belief, this core belief can help guide any company to know you know, when you pivot, how are you pivoting? It's not just in response to the outside business conditions. What should you do? If there's an opportunity to take something new on, is it right for you? Like, do you actually have the core belief that will make that useful and arguably make it fruitful? This is an exercise that you, and again, ideally as whether you're a founder or a senior team member, you should have a small focused team and maybe maybe an outside consultant or a partner to help you work through this. It doesn't have to be 6 months and $1 million. It just has to be focused, and you have to have an empowered team that helps you get to it. Now let's talk about knowing your audience and understanding their need states. And this is something where I think, especially really sales-focused organizations or relationship-focused organizations, it's going to be threatening to salespeople, to be honest. And I think that you shouldn't look at marketing and sales as competing things. They really are complementary. So if I were an early-stage company and I was trying to find my, you know, first 10 or my, you know, second 90 clients, I would talk to my top sales contacts or my top sales prospects. And then don't think about them as a person and what your relationship with them is personally. Think about them as a persona. What's their title? Industry should be easy. Where do they live? What are they interested in? And then again, demo and psychographics here are useful. Demographics, I'm sure you're all familiar with. Psychographics are a little more like what matters to them, what do they think? So abstract back from the person to what that person is like. That will enable you to do a huge amount of really useful work in social media and search. Because you're going to target what are called lookalike audiences. You aren't targeting an individual person. This next one is really the user or customer journey. And again, this can be the work of 6 months, or it can be the work of an afternoon with a whiteboard. Map out that journey from the person who's ultimately going to engage you, from when they identify their initial need through when they start to do their research and maybe make contact with you and several of your competitors, all the way through to when they make the purchase decision or when somebody above them makes the purchase decision. Again, I want to say thanks to my friend Josh again too for sort of talking me through some of the federal procurement and sales and budgeting process here. I think that one of the key ideas here, well, right below, is think about in that journey, what are the points of influence? When can somebody change their mind? When does somebody have a critical decision or recommendation to make? And how can you make them the smartest person in the room and influence how they communicate up? So part of the idea is, like, you know, again, finding a champion, making them one of the smartest people in the room, and taking your message forward. And then I think one of the last pieces here is creating, once you get into creation, is relevant and resonant content. Again, I recognize that it's alliterative, which is part of the marketing magic. But if you think about relevant and resonant, this I think can help you steer in the right direction. So if you can find the overlap between your brand and your product and service and your audience, in that space is where you should be creating your content. Think about whether, again, that can be very temporary. That could be something that's driven by the COVID crisis, could be driven by a planning or procurement cycle, or it can just be driven by a more enduring need. Interestingly, my last place of work, when the COVID crisis hit, we were talking about prom season. Prom season's massive, obviously, for any of us who have kids of that age group. So Teen Vogue came up with this idea to launch Teen Vogue Prom, and it was a virtual prom. They got some talent. They divided it up by geography, and then sold sponsorship against that. It was a really smart and fast pivot, but it was just something they had authority. Their audience had a need, and they found it quickly and created into it. And then next, about creating content that addresses a need, I think there's a difference. A lot of what I see on LinkedIn demonstrates expertise and knowledge, but it doesn't necessarily address a need. You're just showing somebody that you're authoritative and you're smart. I think part of this too is being benefits driven, not features driven. You know, ticking all the boxes of all the things that, again, whether a service or product needs to be is good, but it's called box ticking for a reason. Everybody's gonna be able to do it who's legitimate. So think about what someone's need is and create into that. And that's part of the way that you create champions and advocates and help them maybe influence sort of top decision makers. Again, I think top decision makers have people coming at them all the time. There's always somebody and someone's always trying to sell to them. Think about the person, again, any of us who've run a company of any size, you don't know everything. You have an expert or a few experts in almost any area that you look to say, hey, what's happening in this space? Find those people and make them the smartest, most interesting people around this area and have them help carry your message forward and evangelize it. when you do it from both a tone perspective and a how it shows up perspective, be true to yourself. You know, if you have kind of a humorous or tongue-in-cheek or sarcastic tone, use that. Like, don't completely whitewash it on LinkedIn. And on the other hand, like, if you are Accenture, don't try to be funny. Like, Accenture is just not funny. They won't be. That's okay. Like, you can, but again, it's when you watch brands try to act like something they aren't, it comes off somewhere between insincere and offensive. And then last, this is really key too, that because you're doing digital marketing, you're doing content marketing, have a hypothesis. And the hypothesis shouldn't just be, I hope people will buy this. But think about what kind of response you want to create in your audience. And then create something that tests that hypothesis. Make it, put it out in the world, and then watch the data as it comes in. You'll see things like time spent, commenting, liking, sharing, clicking, whether they actually come over to your site or contact you. Watch that. And if what you thought was going to happen happens, double down. Like, do it again. Like, don't, I'm not saying like ride it all the way into the sun, but spend time with it. If it didn't happen, think about why. The chances are, like, there's probably a logical reason why you missed. This is my experience in e-commerce is huge here. If anybody's ever worked in e-commerce, you start watching your pathing. And again, whether it was Domino's.com or whether it was VW.com, you have to watch, see where people drop out, see where there's like some unexpected uptick. There's always an anomalous, almost always an anomalous piece of data that's going to surprise you. And if you spend time with it, it'll teach you something, and then optimize against it. And then last, so this is from a content marketing perspective, when you actually go in to create things. And here's part of the challenge, right? Like, I think, although interestingly, I'm sure all of you are deep in the direct-to-consumer beauty space, but there have been a few billionaires created in the direct-to-consumer beauty space in the last couple of years. And a lot of them didn't start with a ton of money. They weren't all Jenners. But they created interesting things, they engaged with interesting people. So first I tell you formats. What I mean by that is, don't create something for LinkedIn and then slice it into 148 character chunks on Twitter or whatever Twitter. I honestly don't go too near Twitter these days, but create your content or version your content for the platform on which it's going to exist. And I think here, just basically, right, like email, you have some level of opt-in. And if you're going to get an open, you'll probably get some level of read. LinkedIn is not email. You know, LinkedIn, you have to catch somebody in their feed and then you have a chance to maybe expand upon it. But here, like, you know, bullets, takeaways are really key. Instagram is, as you probably know, like 90% visual. Dropping a big chunk of text on Instagram will just get, like, you will not stop the thumb. People will scroll right past it. And then to be honest, I think Facebook, my guess is most of you aren't marketing on Facebook. I think my personal opinion is I think Facebook has real potential for brand damage. I think showing up on Facebook puts you in difficult company right now, and it's not necessarily the place you want to be. And Twitter, interestingly, a few months ago, I would have really cautioned people on Twitter as well. I think Twitter right now is trying to figure out what having a conscience is going to mean for their business. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch that space and see what happens. Franchises. Content marketing is tough. And starting with a blank screen every week and having to make something for your audience is a challenge. So I would argue you shouldn't try to reinvent yourself every week or every month. Come up with a franchise. If you're going to do an industry update, do an industry update every month, put it out, give it a title, give it a name. A, it's easier for you to create, and B, you have a chance to create fans and followers that way. When your audience starts to expect and wonder what your next piece of content in this vein is going to be, you have already won. And your marketing gets cheaper. This other piece, so modeling the engagement you want. This is interesting, especially if you're getting ready to launch into social media and you haven't done a ton of it. Think about how you're going to engage with your audience. When people comment, how are you going to comment back? If somebody flames you or comes at you in a more aggressive way, are you going to respond? Are you not going to respond? And especially here too, I think, you know, there are brands and products and industries that would have never imagined they were political. And now they're political. So I would also tell you, think through a crisis comms plan. And again, I'm not saying that, you know, your whatever CTO gets taken to jail. I'm saying, like, you accidentally wade into an argument and you get retweeted. And now all of a sudden you're in the middle of a gender debate and you make software for satellites. It can happen. So think through what you're gonna do. Going quiet is an option. Gently apologizing and stepping back is an option. But I would tell you to game it out ahead of time. Because if it happens, you have to do it fast, it really sucks. And I think the danger is, I think we've all been there, right? Like, I think there's more than one person in this country that rage tweets. So I'd tell you too, like, if you have a plan in place, you won't accidentally step into it deeper. And then last, I think you probably all know this, but I think the when you're putting out content marketing, you want people to repeat it. Now, whether they share that to someone, whether they comment back to you, just make sure that somebody understands, you know, at the top, this is what I want to talk to you about and why. At the bottom, this is what I want you to believe and maybe what I want you to do next. Again, a clear call to action here is sort of rule number one of digital marketing. So that's it. So just again, a quick recap. If you're a founder, you're an entrepreneur, you're in a really confusing and massive but radically democratized landscape, and that should be good news. If you clearly understand yourself and your voice and your behaviors and you differentiate and you know your audience, and then again, you don't just shoot in the dark with content, but you really seek to bring those two things together. My mouth's a little dry, but that is my spiel for today. I'm happy to take any questions.
Yeah, I thought your presentation was super interesting. And I was curious about how you think, what is the best platform? If Facebook is brand damaging and Twitter is like trying to find their footing, what is the best platform in terms of media? Is it television? Is it, you know, podcasts? Is it doing webinars? What is the best way to get out there?
It's a great question. I think the answer is it completely depends on your brand and your audience. You know, if for instance, I were launching an ETF, if I remember correctly, or if I were giving financial advice, I think there you would want to be in a serious authoritative space. So I would argue that I would probably start with LinkedIn. I think honestly, webinars are a great way to actually potentially directly engage with folks. But again, I think Instagram for consumer products or even potentially tech products. Again, LinkedIn for especially professional services or something where you're asking someone to trust you in a more explicit way. Again, I think LinkedIn is almost in danger. I'm sure a lot of you all get, you know, somewhere between 3 and 50 invites a week on LinkedIn. And I think it's getting a little crowded, but I think it's still a place where if you publish, it's going to go to some degree to your network. And there's a, you know, a reasonable level of sort of discourse on there. So that would be my guidance. Again, Facebook, Facebook is kind of junk mail for a social media age. Twitter is sort of fine. The danger is just you end up next to something dangerous, or end up next to something you don't want to be next to. The other piece, if you create a solid video asset, you know, buying 6-second, you know, pre-roll or mid-roll on YouTube is not a bad idea. There's just a higher barrier of asset creation.
What are your thoughts on digital marketing for more of a building relationship rather than a transactional business to get their attention where you can compete on value versus transactional price where they're getting flooded by 50 vendors marketing, you know, the various, you know, sticks of snake oil back and forth? How do you differentiate in a digital space?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's interesting. I was thinking about this, again, talking with my buddy Josh that's on here. I was just talking with my father-in-law who runs a company that makes basically technology parts for the railroad. And I was actually likening it to talking with some of the people in the fashion industry that I've worked with over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I think the key there is that if you can make your contact smarter, more authoritative and more influential, you will probably win. Versus like you said, trying to slug it out, selling them something. So I think that's where, again, easier to say than to do, but that's where thought leadership marketing really, really comes in. And that's the important point of thinking about what someone's need is. Again, certainly how your product or service addresses it, but help educate them or redimensionalize the problem for them, inform them about something new, talk about what's coming next. This couldn't be farther from the defense world, but I was pitching a big fashion and apparel company that's part of an even bigger holding company. And so I went to speak with some of the editors at Vogue and things like that. And then I got like a direct lift quote from Anna Wintour. And I went in and talked to the CEO and just said, listen, like, I can help you, but a lot of people can help you. Here's what we see coming in your industry. Here's what we think is important. And here's where we think there's overlap for you. And then again, we talked about, again, there I had a little bit of an inside scoop because I knew what was going to be coming in 100 days from Vogue. But that doesn't mean, I'm sure your company must have a point of view on what's going to be happening in this space. Yeah. So I guess I would couch it more in terms of like how you see the world shaping up, how you understand the problem from a different dimension, and then again, make that person smarter. I think again, part of the challenge here is sometimes that thought leadership marketing is better received when you go down a rung from, you know, whether it's a CEO or a flag officer, whoever it is, go down a rung to the person that's going to be taking their need to them and arm them with everything they could possibly need to look better and smarter. And then, you know, you don't ever have to have the relationship in theory, or you can just be the person who comes in at the end and saves the day. You've just helped create a champion and push somebody up and advance them in their career.
I guess I want to personalize that more. Let me just pull that string one more thread, and then I'll let somebody else chat. But in the digital space, trying to scale this, mm-hmm. you know, to thousands of post camps and stations across the services, you know, a bespoke one-to-one letter is a very time-consuming touch labor cost. So how does a small startup scale digitally to make that more personalization? Every government person I know hates being added to a MailChimp mailing list, right? Yeah. You know, they just go insane. Don't ever talk to me again. Yeah. But yet they're very secretive about their cell phone numbers and so forth. So
one of the tricks, especially in social and digital marketing and media is if somebody hears about something from one source, you know, they might be aware, or they might just sort of gloss past it.
Right.
So let's say, for instance, you're trying to promote a product in this space. So let's say I see it on LinkedIn because you put up, whether it's a white paper or like a thought piece presentation, you know, 5 to 6 slides, you put that up, you target people who have a specific title, or boost that so it shows up in their feed. Then next, again, whether it's on an email list or something like that, and then third, like when you've got a sales rep who can send that to them, you know, just directly via email or whatever, and say, hey, I'm not sure if you saw this, something we put out, I thought you might be interested.
Right.
When you can triangulate someone, I'm misusing triangulate. When someone sees it from a few different sources,
sure.
It all of a sudden becomes, it feels more important. It feels more authoritative. It's also, you know, let's say you've got 1,000 person target market. If you hit 300 of them, with something boosted on, again, let's just call it LinkedIn for the moment. And then another 100 of them see it from another space, they'll also probably be talking about it. Or there's a greater chance of them saying, did you see, this is kind of interesting. These guys are talking about it this way. And then all of a sudden you've also kind of recontextualized the conversation. So I'd say it's not about one contact point. Ideally it's about trying to get 3, but with the same bullets, with the same message.
What is the most effective way, on mobile games that, like, what's working right now?
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think there's two ways to think about that. And I mean, I play enough mobile games and I've got 3 kids, so I see a lot of what's out there. What I see in that space is like a high low. Either people are doing, things that look and feel, you know, again, this is either they're advertising games in like a game space, or you're doing like real, like just straight direct response. You know, it's like 6 seconds of video, maybe you'll be interested. And the reason for that is it's super low cost in most places to advertise
What is that? Like, what is that? Say I'm a business and I want to advertise on a mobile game. What is the best way to go about that?
Oh yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, that would be a good follow-up question. Cause it's basically like you can go in a lot of different ways. You can sometimes buy direct. Sometimes you have to buy through like a media network. But you can basically go in, and then they offer different levels of targeting. It's, you know, again, it, depending on what you're advertising, it can either be a great space, or just to be, my personal opinion is advertising something that's not a mobile game in mobile games. You have to be careful. The context is weird. You don't necessarily have a ton of control. Like, you're not generally buying ad space in a specific app or game. You're buying a game network. So you'll buy with King through their media arm, and they'll just put you like, not wherever, but you don't really know what the context is gonna be. So you could end up next to something like really bloody and objectionable, or you could end up next to something with like, you know, polar bears and popping balloons. So it really depends on what you're advertising and how you wanna show up. Again, it's a high engagement space. There's a ton of reach. My opinion is the best reason to advertise in a mobile game is if you want somebody to go download an app, just because you're right there. Advertising for awareness in the mobile space, like, it's just too easy for me to be playing and the ad comes on and I just do that and I wait for 30 seconds. So anyway, but that's what I'd say. I think, again, if you're not selling a game or an entertainment property, there may be other ways to get your message out. So again, that's personal opinion. There's probably media people who are smarter about it than I am. I've been much more on the strategy and creative side.
To have a very good digital marketing strategy, does it require a massive investment for a startup? Is it affordable?
Yes.
For a startup to really have a good one? And my second question, which I'll ask everyone, is there a difference between B2B and B2C for digital marketing? But the first one is cost. Does it have to be expensive? Thanks.
No, that's fair. So I think the cost, especially in digital and social, is highly, highly variable. I think you can, you know, you can run, again, it really depends on your audience, how big it is. You know, if you have a 500 person audience that aren't ultra high net worth individuals, or a 5,000 person audience, like getting to most of that audience doesn't have to be too expensive. If you have a 5 million person audience, just, so in media, you'd think about reach and frequency. Reach is the percentage of your audience that you actually get to, and frequency is how many times they see it. So a bigger audience is harder. I think how crowded a space is really influences the cost. So for instance, if you try to buy the ad word pizza, it's gonna be expensive. If you try to buy the ad word, pizza, Sarasota, Florida, you know, pineapple, it's gonna get a lot cheaper. What I'd say is in digital and social, you can scale your investment a ton. And you can also experiment a lot, which is really useful. So you can actually test something in a small space and be like, is this message resonating? Are people doing something with it or not? I've actually even worked on things where we've test marketed names or taglines for products before they were launched with what's called like a blind link, just to see what the response looks like. B2B versus B2C. I would argue the old wisdom was that B2B was really different than B2C. And one of the places I saw this manifest a lot was like CES, right? Like if you guys have been to CES, you know, like there it feels very, very B2B. It's a lot of very big screens, a lot of like attract loops on conference floors. It's about arresting someone's attention. And then all of a sudden it gets really boring, right? All of a sudden you're talking about like rack space, or you're talking about, you know, teraflops. Like you skip straight from like, welcome to Las Vegas to like, you know, here's how many plugs you can put into this thing. That's a terrible metaphor. But anyway, so I think B2B, you are still marketing to a person. Now you're marketing them as like somebody who probably has like some kind of large scale purchasing responsibility or large scale decision responsibility. But I think you shouldn't appear frivolous, but you should still talk to them like a human. You're not actually you can't talk to IBM. You can only talk to the CTO of IBM, you know? So I would argue it doesn't have to be nearly as different. And B2B doesn't have to be boring. In the same way too, again, the AFWERX videos I was looking at, again, they weren't boring. They just were identical. You don't have to be identical either. Like I know the military is a different, whole different thing, but these are still humans, right? These are still people who buy soda and toilet paper and cars. And also I'd suggest if you're in the military space, look at the ads that the armed forces do. Like they're good. All their content is good. They pay a ton of money, or we pay a ton of money for them to build really great ads that work generally. So I think there's an expectation of high quality, interesting messaging. There's a quick question here about on the side from John, that Kantar gave a presentation to you guys and said 50% of ads effectiveness is based on content. I think I have no idea how you would ever arrive at that stat unless you did like a giant, you know, I respect Kantar. I used to work with him a lot. I just think it really depends. What I'd argue is like, there's an old famous saying that's, I think it was the CMO of Procter & Gamble that said, I know half of my marketing budget is wasted. I just don't know which half. So what I'd say is like, everything is important. Media and targeting is important. The content and creative is important. You can't do one without the other.
So my question is, and thank you for the fantastic presentation and this discussion. So one of my clients is an artificial intelligence startup who works in the national security and public health space. Mm-hmm. So we see our digital presence as primarily for vetting purposes, just for people to check out that we're legit, we do exist. So we're not really looking, at least at the moment, about marketing, but more just to have that presence. So I guess there's two questions. First, are we correct, do you think, to view things that way, given that we're targeting government agencies and public institutions like universities, public health entities? Mm-hmm. So are we correct to view things that way? And then secondly, if we are correct that that's okay, at least for now, how active and broadly represented do we need to be online?
Yeah. So I think, to be honest, unless your website is transactional, I think your website is one of the things you can spend the least time on. Because the, like, you're going to have, like, to your point, someone has to get there. So either they've already heard of you or you came up in a search result. So I think your website, for that person, should be useful, right? Should let somebody learn more about you and get in contact with you easily. But I think, again, unless you're specifically like car websites cost $20 million because you have to be able to like complete the first, you know, 50% of the purchase journey there. If it's other than that, I think that's probably the right way to go. The question about whether or not that's the right thing to do in terms of, is that all you should do or most of what you should do? Part of the question would be how strong your sales ground game is, and especially how strong is your sales ground game right now. And assuming that we might be in a place where we're not, you know, getting together for coffees or flying around the country a lot for the next, you know, whatever, 400 years, next year, like I think that your other contact channels become really critical. So I'd say, like, and again, it is a question of priorities and where you put your resources. So, you know, should you divert 50% of your sales resources to doing, you know, thought leadership pieces that you can push out on email and social networks? Like, I don't know. It kind of depends on if you already have contact with the 100 people you need to, or the 1,000 people you need to. I wouldn't pull that many resources away. That said, I mean, you know, again, a presentation like I did today takes 4 or 5 days. You can put out an interesting point of view. You can then publish that out. So I think even if you're taking the things that your sales team is taking out and sort of generalizing them, again, assuming you're not violating anyone's any classified, like, you know, you put it and putting it out in the world to tell people what your point of view is and how you see the world. I think that's worth doing. And it's just a question of, yeah, how much resource do you need to divert? Again, that said, there were a lot of people who had big sales ground games, you know, hundreds of salespeople out in the world who are all, you know, gearing up to go to, you know, South by Southwest or CES or Davos. And now they can't do that. So how do you get your next wave of contacts? If you don't have a presence out there in the world, you don't have things that you can point to, it's going to be tough.
So that kind of queued up my question. How do you recommend we tie these things? Like, we've talked about like an email marketing, like a newsletter kind of thing. We've talked about doing just LinkedIn. How do we tie these things, make it consistent without being like obnoxious and overwhelming?
Yeah. Well, I think there's two questions there. One is what I would call channel strategy. So you have, you know, you have several ways that you're going to be able to reach your customers or potential customers. Think about what you want each of those channels to do. And that's part of thinking about that customer journey. So where, like, at what stage is somebody likely to encounter you on LinkedIn? At what stage are they likely to get and open one of your emails? Think about that and think about what stage it is in their decision journey. And that will kind of tell you that, I think that will tell you like what the role of that channel should be. I think you're already like a lot of the way there because you're not thinking about like, let's just do the same thing on 5 channels. And cause that's when you get irritating, right? That's when it's like, you just boosted that to me on LinkedIn and I just got an email. Like, you value my time less than I'd like you to. So that's what I'd say. Like, think about a channel strategy. Like, what do you want each of those things to accomplish? Now the tough thing in the digital world is you can't manage the order in which people find those things. Mm-hmm. But that way, if each of them has some, a role in what happens, then I think that can steer you in the right direction. Again, I don't know if this is gonna be a helpful example for you, but like Budweiser, for instance. So Budweiser uses TV to talk about product and product innovation, and they use social to create brand love. So they're like, that's it. So you even, again, now the Super Bowl is an outlier here, but when you see a Budweiser commercial, it's gonna largely be about the product. And then when you see them on social, it's going to be about their community and the brand and the thing, like the things that like that matter to them. And so I think even just at that like basic level, think about what those channels should do for you, and then have them do those different things well. And then too, if you have a pretty distinct channel strategy, your chances of hitting wear out or irritating somebody are lower.
Awesome. So you said earlier too, you said to kind of reflect what you want from your customers. Should we be commenting on other things, other posts? Should we be sharing other things that we find interesting? I'm curious your thoughts on that.
It's a good question. And a lot of that, I think, depends on your kind of brand persona, right? Like if your brand is sort of part of a community and that's how you want to be seen, then I think commenting on other people's or other companies' activities can be a really useful way. It's also, I mean, I think it's funny. One of my friends, good friends, is a tattoo artist, and I just decided like to divert some like intern time a couple of years ago to help him grow his audience. And the strategy was actually really cross-linking and cross-following. And that built his audience on Instagram from about 600 to 15,000 in 2 months, without spending any money. It was just he was expressing interest in some of these communities and specific places that he would travel to and do his work. So I think that can be a really good strategy. In terms of like commenting, I think that again, the question there is like, yeah, like to what end, right? Are you expressing your point of view? It's always a little more dangerous when I say pick a fight, I don't mean like really wade in swinging, but even if you were going to counter someone's point of view, I think you have to think really hard about how you do that, how you do it in a respectful way, and this is where I say like model the engagement you want from your audience. So if you want to start a respectful but robust debate, then start it, you know? And even like, this is one of the most amazing things. It's funny, I didn't mention Reddit. I think Reddit is a fantastic place for tech brands to be. It's an amazing place, and you can pick subreddits, and subreddits have rules. Every single subreddit has a set of rules for how you can and can't interact there. And I think those can be interesting places to go in and like and start a conversation, but you have to be ready to have it. And you want to understand like the rules and what you want out of it.
Hey, John, this has been tremendously enlightening. We have pages of notes, much of which we don't really understand. When you talk about a distinct channel strategy, I mean, we're not even sure what the channels are. You know, what are the, if you have, as you alluded to, a financial services product, how does one start? Like, we don't, you know, sort of know what are steps, you know, maybe not one, but steps 2 through 10.
I think even just when we met up and talked last year, I think you both know your audience. I think, right? Like, you understand who are going to be the consumers and people with whom you engage. So I'll just like start there. Start from a, like, even like, both of you are professionals in this area. Think about where you digest content. Where do you actually participate? What do you do? And start thinking about it from that point. The goal there too, I think, is then to be able to abstract back, like just one step back to say like, okay, so it's not your personal preference, but how do you generalize that a bit? Even to hit up 5 or 10, like, so one of the things when I started the agency at Condé Nast, I reached out to 5 CMOs that were, you know, friends or former colleagues. And I was just like, hey, I want to form an advisory group. I want your help because I want to build something in response to the market. And that was a huge part of how we created the actual service set and the pricing and all that model, just by asking people what they wanted. Now, I know sometimes, like, you know, secrecy or protecting your IP means that can be a challenge, but I'd argue like, you know, build a small advisor group and go from, you know, start with something like that, just to understand, because you'll always have blind spots.
You're crossing the valley of death. How do you, and you have multiple markets and customers, how do you make the decision? And then what does budget look like if you need like 5 to 10 seconds of like either a polished commercial or radio spot?
It's fair. I think the media choice is a little downstream. What I would say is it sounds to me like your product is almost a connector between these things, right? There are people who have a need to be upskilled, and there are people who need an upskilled workforce. So I think in terms of how they will consume your product, it is, I'm sure they're different, but there's an overlap in the mission. There's actually a great article from Andreessen Horowitz called The Great Rehiring. A little tangential, but saying that like the most important work of the next 2 years is going to be helping people like find meaningful work again. And that, like, that matters for hiring people, for CEOs or you know, high level government employees, all the way to the workforce that needs to be upskilled. So I would start there. And then I think you don't necessarily have to completely differentiate your message. You can say like, listen, what we believe is that like what this country requires is a, you know, higher skilled, better trained, ready to go out there workforce. Everybody needs that. And so here's how we serve these couple of audiences. You know, from your perspective, we'll deliver you an upskilled, ready to go to work workforce. And from the worker side, we're gonna help you be ready to be that person. Mm-hmm. Where are you in media? Tough to say in a 5 to 10 second. Radio can be really effective. Again, TV is crushingly expensive and most people look away during ads. So unless you can afford the, you know, football, you know, it's tough to say, but I think start there with like, you've got overlap. They just have a different outcome. The call to action at the end is just a bit different. Mm-hmm. But that should let you get out there. And then again, just ask yourself, I'm sure you're talking to some of these people, where do they consume media? Where's the best place to find them? And then what can you afford? And again, that you can do an informal focus group too. Just say, when you're looking for training, where do you go?
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deaf.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deaf.org/join. That's deaf.org/join.